It's May 5th, 1893, and you're setting foot in Chicago's Jackson Park to see for yourself what this whole Chicago World's Fair thing is all about. The fair aims to honor the 400th anniversary of Columbus's sailing to America, but you're here for different reasons. Here, you see American ingenuity on display. You handle samples of new inventions, such as something called the zipper. You take a ride on the first Ferris wheel. You eat something called a hamburger sandwich, complete with a fizzy drink called a soda. You also hear the first voice recording, which leaves you really stunned and believing in magic. You are one of 27 million people who partook in this singular event through the course of 5 months. At the time, you didn't know it, but this event would be called the Fair That Changed America. This is because underneath the veneer of celebration, imagination, and bustle, a dark underbelly writhed, claiming the lives of the unsuspecting. Hidden in plain sight, a monster laid in wait, the likes of which America had never seen. Today, I'll be telling you about the story of America's first urban serial killer, H.H. Holmes. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Haunted History. I'm your host, Megan, and each week I'll be taking you on a little journey through our world's haunted history. Thank you so much to everyone who checked out our Patreon. We have some exciting new content coming for you, including trips to haunted locations. You heard that right. I will be visiting actual haunted locations, showing you guys around, talking about what makes them haunted and ghost stories associated with them, and of course, share a little bit about their history. That's going to be a really fun addition to our Patreon, and we hope you guys like it. Well, Christmas is just around the corner. It's soon December, and it's really known as a time of love and happiness and giving and family, but it also has a dark side. And in December, we are going to be exploring those dark stories. So stay tuned for some holiday horror. Now, that's all the updates I have for you today. If you want more, you can visit our Patreon, patreon.com/hauntedhistorypod. But for now, let's get to today's story. Content warning, this episode contains extreme violence, animal violence, emotional and physical abuse, and child violence. Herman Webster Mudgett was born on May 16, 1861, in a small, isolated town in New Hampshire. Herman's family carried some wealth, and his parents were devout Methodists. As a part of their belief system, they expected complete obedience from their children. Herman's father, Levi Mudgett, was a violent alcoholic who was not above using his physical strength against his children. Herman's mother, Theodate Price, was described as being cold and distant. This resulted in an upbringing characterized by a prolonged cocktail of physical and emotional abuse. It's said that Herman was subjected to harsh disciplinary tactics, with food restriction and prolonged isolation being wielded often and without mercy. Perhaps it was in those instances, when care and protection eluded him, that young Herman's soul bisected from himself, because by all accounts, it's said that although he was an intelligent child, Herman was also prone to acts of cruelty. In the forest near his childhood home, it's said that Herman would conduct experiments on animals, even going as far as performing live dissections. Perhaps it was in those instances that young Herman gained a semblance of control. As we now understand from modern psychology, abuse often flows in cycles. Perhaps in imposing pain on beings weaker than he, Herman found control in his own upside-down world, a world where his caregivers were ultimately his perpetrators. Now, dear listener, let it be known here that this is merely an attempt to present you with what is known of the origin story of a man who will later be known as the Devil in the White City. By no means are we attempting to excuse any of his future behavior. Call it a peek behind the veil, if you will. So, in the forest, young Herman wielded what little power he had. In another addendum to this origin story, I will add this extra slice of information. It's said that Herman's good grades had drawn the ire of some of his classmates, who had teased him mercilessly. This culminated in a group of boys forcing him into a local doctor's office and running the hands of a real human skeleton across his face. Herman, in the throes of extreme bullying, endured a moment of both abject terror and humiliation. Interestingly, this moment is later stated as being the origin point for his future interest in human anatomy. You see, during this period in history, real skeletons were often used and showcased in doctors' offices. They were also quite high in demand in institutions of higher learning. When Herman was 11 years old, he was exploring an abandoned house with one of his only friends, a slightly older boy named Tom. It's said that during their playtime, Tom ventured too close to the edge of a landing and accidentally tumbled to his death. Now, needless to say, considering what's known of the man Herman will eventually grow up to be, there has been speculation that at just 11 years old, he had actually been the one to push Tom to his death. Herman's dark impulses would find a conduit through many avenues. He channeled his deviancy and morbid fascination with anatomy into a field of study. He enrolled at the University of Michigan Medical School in 1879, using money that he had co-opted from his short-lived marriage to a woman named Clara Levering to bankroll his endeavor. This also brings us to another of Herman's conduits, fraud. It appeared as though Herman was pathologically incapable of doing things the right way. He used deception in order to get what he wanted. In Clara's case, the fact that she was left abandoned by Holmes means that she was, in fact, one of the lucky ones. In medical school, Herman's studies went well. He was an intelligent man and by all means seemed to manufacture genuine interest in the subject of anatomy. However, as we touched upon, it appears that his interest was anything but altruistic. Herman supplemented his studies with the procurement of real cadavers that he would then dissect and study. He fell into a pattern of habitual grave robbing, selling in turn those very same cadavers to medical schools and morgues. Herman's dark impulses were seasoned with lesser crimes like fraud. He really was not above using deception in every breath of his existence. During this period, Herman peppered his time with not only academia, but also insurance fraud. It's said that he would heavily burn or disfigure the stolen cadavers and plant them in horrific scenes designed to make them appear as having suffered accidental deaths. But the macabre theater did not end there. Herman would then collect the life insurance money on those poor souls, having cunningly placed himself as the sole beneficiary beforehand. This ruse created an influx of money for Herman, who had by then been married multiple times, or at least he had been married many times concurrently, having many wives in many different cities at the same time. In 1886, while still legally married to Clara, Herman married 24-year-old Murda Belknap in Minneapolis, Minnesota. In 1894, while still married to both Clara and Murda, he married another woman named Georgiana Yoke in Denver, Colorado. That's right, his deceitful nature bled into his romantic life. In his book titled Depraved, true crime author Harold Schechter explores the idea that Herman was a true psychopath, He maintains that he derived pleasure from exerting deceit and power in every interaction in his life. In his relationship with women, he would derive pleasure from ensnaring a woman romantically, only to then discard her. His nature as a fraudster translated to his whole existence as a human being. His being was janky, held up by a crude scaffolding made of deceit, sadism, and eventually cold-blooded murder. Shortly after graduating from medical school in 1884, he began using the moniker Dr. Henry Howard Holmes and would be known henceforth as H.H. Holmes, which is how we'll refer to him from now on in our story. This allowed him to have a clean slate and distance himself from his fraudulent marriages, as well as the various body snatcher insurance scams that could gum up the works of his fresh start. The name change, coupled with his graduation and newfound status as a doctor, cemented the idea that Holmes was adding layers of deception to his fragile, true self. In a distinctly predatory way, Holmes was given access to tools, both physical and societal, as a means to allow his dark compulsions to be expressed in an unfettered way. After graduating, Holmes set his sights on the Windy City. It was in the Chicago neighborhood of Englewood on 63rd and Wallace that he landed his first job as a medical professional, working in the local pharmacy owned by a man named Dr. E.S. Holton. Dr. Holton passed away, having been stricken for some time with cancer. His surviving wife, Elizabeth, was left to tend shop. Now, as we mentioned earlier, Holmes delighted in manipulation. He was a man noted as being quite handsome, with dark hair and piercing blue eyes, as well as mysterious. The pharmacist's wife was persuaded by Holmes to sell him the business. Once the paperwork was signed and a payment plan drawn up, Holmes desisted on payments, finding excuses left, right, and center for not being able to come up with his dues. Elizabeth, for her part, sued Holmes for non-payment. A short time later, she mysteriously left for California and was never seen again. Holmes, for his part, never paid one red cent for the business. When it comes to Holmes' lore, it's largely accepted that Holmes had a role in her disappearance. However, there has been some debunking when it comes to the dispatching of the owners of the Englewood Pharmacy. Chicago tour guide Adam Seltzer did some findings in 2013 that highlighted the fact that Dr. E.S. Holton stood for Dr. Elizabeth Sarah Holton, and that the pharmacy actually belonged to her. What's more, Dr. Holton seemed to have been very much alive and still living on 63rd Street by the time Holmes took over her business. She did also leave for California when her daughter turned two, meaning that in this case, the lurid and lore have morphed over time, shedding elements of truth in the process. With the pharmacy generating a decent revenue, Holmes allowed himself to make grand plans. You see, in front of the pharmacy stood an empty lot. As he toiled the day away, handling prescription drugs and mingling with folks in the neighborhood, Holmes almost passed as a regular, amiable person. But underneath the veneer of acceptability, a plan was being hatched. Like a coiled snake, Holmes was biding his time. Before him, the empty lot stood, and like the city that was erecting itself around him, his visions for what would stand in its wake coalesced. From his deeply turmoiled mind emerged the blueprints to a house of horrors. In 1889, Holmes undertook the construction of a three-story building that locals would call the castle. He had purchased the empty lot sometime before, likely from money generated by many of the elaborate scams and frauds that he was undertaking at any given time. The construction of the hotel was characterized by an endless stream of various construction crews. Crews would be hired to build certain sections of the building and would be promptly fired, often without being paid. This meant that no one other than Holmes could paint a full picture of the building as a whole. Having only contributed pieces of the puzzle in a disjointed fashion, the endless stream of workers had unwillingly built a murder castle. The building was the architectural equivalent to the inner machinations of a sadistic mind. Described as being labyrinthine, it had corridors that went in circles, a confusing layout, and staircases that led to nowhere. On the first floor, there were shops and small apartments that speckled the floor above. It was said that some of the rooms were outfitted with peepholes to ensure that Holmes could assuage his voyeuristic tendencies. But this is only the tip of the iceberg. Legend has it that some, if not all, of the lodgings possessed secret vents by which a poisonous gas could spill over, incapacitating unsuspecting and often sleeping lodgers. These rooms were also said to have greased chutes, whereby the unconscious or sometimes already deceased bodies would fall two stories into the basement. And it's in the basement, dear listeners, that Holmes was free to exert the pinnacle of his power. The basement is said to have contained a table for dissection, a torture chamber, as well as implements that served for the purpose of disposing of victims' bodies, quicklime vats, and a crematorium. In a callback to his earlier foray into fraud, Holmes reportedly sold the skeletons of his victims to schools and doctors' offices. But who were Holmes's victims, and how did they fall into the clutches of a man who had built a monument to his depravity? In 1893, like a phoenix rising from the ashes, Chicago beat out the likes of New York, Washington, and St. Louis for the right to host the World's Columbian Exposition. This was on the tail end of the 1871 Great Chicago Fire, and Chicago was poised to showcase how it had successfully rebuilt itself, and then some. America itself was on the heels of the Civil War, which had ended only 28 years before. As our story unfolds, we are in the Gilded Age, a time American history was characterized by rapid innovation, immigration, and an economic boom. It's in this shifting climate that hordes of people descended upon Chicago. Many of them were women who were enjoying new freedoms, such as the right to work. H.H. Holmes, ever the opportunist, saw an opening to turn his building into a makeshift hotel, shifting his tenants from long-term to short-term. In this sense, the building became a veritable revolving door for vulnerable women seeking work and a place to stay during the fair. Only many people in the neighborhood would say, lots of women seemed to go into the hotel, whereas very few came out. Just like the tales about the pharmacy owners, parsing out the truth from the morbid scandal is an exercise in caution. Although the extent of Holmes's intent with the murder castle can be debated, the fact that he was a disturbed man is not. With the range of murders attributed to him oscillating between 9 and 200, let us situate ourselves with the known victims of this depraved man. A man named Dr. Lawrence Connor lived in Holmes's building, alongside his wife, Julia Smythe, and their young daughter, 2-year-old Pearl Connor. H.H. Holmes was besotted with Julia, perhaps even more so because she was a striking woman who was already taken. He and Julia had a lengthy affair, which resulted in Connor leaving his wife and child behind. Julia, it's said, demanded that Holmes marry her. Ultimately, she and Pearl disappeared shortly after. Holmes admitted that Julia died during an abortion, and as for Pearl, he said that he suffocated her to death. Skeletal remains that fit both of their descriptions, Julia was nearly 6 feet tall, are said to have been found in Holmes's cellar. Holmes would eventually employ a second in command, a sort of enabler named Benjamin Petezl. Petezl was a carpenter by trade, but a criminal at heart. He was also deep in the throes of alcoholism. Holmes used Petezl as a handyman and employed him to do his dirty work. It's said that Petezl made a visit to a rival doctor who peddled a vaccine that cured alcoholism. This, presumably, was at Holmes's behest. Petezl returned from his recon mission, no less cured, but armed with another type of drug. He told Holmes that in the doctor's employ was the most beautiful woman he had ever seen. Holmes, ever the psychopath, knew that he must have her. Her name was Emmeline Sigrand. Emmeline Sigrand was just 23 years old when she met Holmes and began working in Holmes's building in May of 1892 and survived for 6 months in his employ. She had apparently left in December 1892 to go marry a mysterious man named Robert Phelps. Her empty luggage sent back to her mother in Anderson, Indiana, in the process. It was sadly later revealed that one of the skeletons that Holmes had sold to a local doctor belonged to Emmeline, meaning that she had most likely met her fate at the hands of Holmes in his murder castle. As for Petezl, even he would not escape unscathed from his unhinged employer. In the fall of 1894, Holmes began planning an insurance ruse that he had executed before, collecting insurance money on a cadaver that was staged in an accidental death. This time, he included Petezl on the take. He convinced Petezl to present himself as an inventor named B.F. Perry, who would then meet an unceremonious end in a lab experiment gone wrong. Having been insured for $10,000, he would split the insurance amount between himself, Holmes, and a lawyer named Jephthah. Jephthah Howe was a lawyer who was brought on board to facilitate the bureaucratic aspect of the scam. Petezl, assuming that Holmes would use one of his famous stolen cadavers, was promptly incapacitated using chloroform, and his body was lit ablaze by benzene. The cadaver, it turns out, was him all along. But the carnage and cruelty didn't stop there. Holmes took it upon himself to deceive Petezl's surviving widow, Carrie Alice Canning, and their children. Carrie was manipulated into leaving three of her children, 13-year-old Alice, 9-year-old Nellie, and 7-year-old Howard, with Holmes. He then took them on a deranged journey to Canada, all the while making Carrie and her two other children believe that their father, Benjamin Petezl, was still alive. Sadly, it appears that Holmes ultimately took the lives of the three Petezl children in his supposed care. The two girls were locked in a trunk and asphyxiated with gas. As for Howard, it appears that he was drugged and his body was chopped up with a knife. In a classic bit that's very characteristic of the United States of America, it was actually Holmes's fraud that got him arrested before his murders. He was ultimately tracked down by the Pinkerton Detective Agency on behalf of an insurance company for his orchestrating of horse thefts in Texas. Ultimately, authorities were led back to the Englewood building during this investigation. The evidence in the hotel was scarce. Some tufts of hair, bones belonging to Julia Smythe and Pearl Connor, as well as personal items that could have belonged to other victims. The easiest way to get justice for Holmes's victims was to try him for the murder of his accomplice and confidant, Benjamin Petezl. In October of 1895, Holmes was tried for Petezl's murder. He was found guilty and sentenced to death. It's following this conviction that Holmes would confess to the killings of 27 people, most of them women. Herman Webster Mudgett did not die quickly. His neck did not snap, thus robbing him of a sweet release. No, he writhed in pain for 15 minutes before finally expiring on May 7th, 1896. Ironically, Holmes demanded that his coffin be encased in concrete, as he didn't want grave robbers to dissect his corpse after death. H.H. Holmes is credited as one of the first urban serial killers. There were instances of serial killings in frontier America, but never ones that operated in the new bustling cities of the post-war Gilded Age. Holmes's depravity is sometimes juxtaposed with another historical serial killer. This is none other than Jack the Ripper, who was operating around 1888 across the pond, with the neighborhood of Whitechapel in London serving as his perverse playground under the cover of darkness. Although it's sometimes difficult to untangle the lore from the truth, one thing is for sure. H.H. Holmes had a fractured soul that was propped up by pillars of deceit, manipulation, and murder. His attempts at controlling his victims plumbed the depths of depravity to the point where he became the architect of his very own murder castle. It was, in a sense, a horrid dollhouse, one where he could subject people, who he verily saw as mere playthings, to untold horrors, many of which will most likely live somewhere between truth and fiction forever. Well, friends, that's it for me today. If you've enjoyed our time spent together, please take a minute and leave a review or give us a rating. And be sure to check out our Patreon if you want to get in on all of the behind-the-scenes action. Have a wonderful week, and I'll see you next Tuesday.